The following programming is sponsored by Don Beischel. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, its management, or Peasley Media Group.
Hey, Uncle Sam, put your name at the top of his list. And the Statue of Liberty started shaking her fist. And the eagle will fly. And it's gonna be...
And good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the Conservative Voice here on WWDB 860 AM. I'm Don Beischel Jr. here along with my good friend and co-host, Gary Heasley. As we do every week, we like to try to do a little things to help the conservative message get out to the folks of Pennsylvania. So before we get to the show, I got an announcement to make, which I think is going to maybe upset some people, but other people will be happy about it. So today is going to be my last show on the air. Gary is going to be taking over the reins. So I have been offered and accepted the position of chief of staff for Senator Doug Mastriano, who is one of our guests today. And so I will be starting that job on Thursday. You know, in my almost 6 years here doing the show, it's interesting that how far we've come. We've had a range of guests on the show, including a senator who in September of 2019 was suggested to me by a good friend of ours, Colonel Frank Ryan. He goes, "Oh, you ought to have this guy on the show." And so sure enough, in September of 2019, Senator Doug Mastriano came on the show. That was the first time he was ever on the show. And the people that listen to the show just fell in love with the guy because, quite frankly, he cares about the people of Pennsylvania and the conservative movement. And then in 2020, when all heck broke loose, there was only one person in government who was willing to step out, and he did his fireside chats every night. And he agreed to come on the show every week. And since then, he's been a mainstay on the show every week. And of course, I had the honor and privilege of being his Southeast Regional Director when he was running for governor. And I would open up my speeches when I would do a speech and I would say, you know, I've had the pleasure of my life of working for three pretty great men. I started out my political career knocking doors for Ronald Reagan. So I'm giving away my age a little bit there. I worked in the polls and knocking doors for Donald Trump, and then I got to work for Doug Mastriano. And those are the three guys that I consider have had the greatest political impact, not only on me, but on the people that, here in Pennsylvania. So if you ever watched The West Wing, there was a moment when the president told his chief of staff to hire this Republican, and because it was a Democratic administration, and basically what Leo McGarry said to Ainsley Hayes, he said your president is asking you to serve. And so Senator Mastriano came to me and asked me to serve, and when that person in your life asked you to serve, you just drop everything and you do it. So that's where I'm going, that's where I'll be, and the show is going to be in Gary's hands. And you know, we'll talk, and you know, anything after Senate hours, I can of course be involved in. But other than that, I'm going to be pretty busy. I have a feeling, anyway. So with that being said, I want to welcome Senator Doug Mastriano to the show. Senator, welcome.
Don, and I am so thankful to have you on the team. It's going to be a great ride, brother.
I think so. I'm looking forward to it. I mean, you know, there's a lot of work to do, and you know, if you're not 100% committed to the state constitution and the U.S. Constitution and the core values and beliefs of the conservative movement, then, you know, you're not there. I mean, that's all there is to it. So, you know, I had this conversation with quite a few people, and I said, if it wasn't Doug, you know, I wouldn't do it. So, that's what it comes down to, you know, because you're the only one, and I say this to people all the time, you're the only one. It's hard, and I say this to people, it's hard when you get elected into a position to resist the temptation to compromise your core values and beliefs. We've seen this with many politicians who start out as, oh, I'm a conservative, I'm a conservative, I'm a conservative. And the next thing you know, when a Doug Mastriano is running for governor, they're out there saying, oh, you know, he's too extreme. He's too this, he's too that, you know. And they fold under the pressure. And you never, in no matter how many times people said to you when you were running, you need to soften your stance on abortion, you need to stop talking about God, you need to do this, you need to do that, you stay true to your beliefs and your core values, and so that does it for me. That's all I need. So.
Well, I appreciate that. You know, Reagan, he never changed. I mean, maybe it doesn't always work out. Lincoln, you know, he really didn't change either with his stance. Now, obviously, he was ginger with the border states that he needed during the Civil War. But,
right.
You know, in the end, he got what he wanted, you know, emancipation and slavery. And Democrat run and controlled slavery at that. And, you know, you're savvy. You were there from the beginning. You resisted Governor Wolf. You called out, you know, Governor Wolf and his minions and Levine and Shapiro during those dark days, especially. You stood with us. You know, you fought hard. You got the word out. You're on top of legislation. Your grasp and depth of politics is deeper than anyone I know. So I think you're going to be a great asset to not just my team, but the Commonwealth as well.
Well, the one thing that I say to people is, you know, you can compromise. You can respect a different opinion as long as you don't give away your basic core values and beliefs. And that's the one thing that, you know, Ronald Reagan was – I always say that one of Reagan's great strengths was if he could come to a deal with Tip O'Neill, and nobody was more opposite of Reagan than Tip O'Neill, and they were able to they were able to come to compromises but without giving away the kitchen sink. And so – you know, part of governing is that you need to know where your core values and beliefs are. And I think that, you know, that's one of your strengths is that you know what your core values are and beliefs are. And all you're asking people to do is if you want me to respect your opinion, you need to respect mine. And then we'll go from there.
Yeah, that's right. You know, and like Reagan said, if we agree 70% of the time, doesn't make us enemies 30% of the time. You know, most of these things that we differ on the Republican side, it might only be 10 or 15% of the time. And, you know, for far too many, that makes you an enemy. That I don't like this vote. I don't like your position on this. Okay, what about all the other issues that we stand on? Well, you know, one thing that really strikes me in politics is the lack of loyalty and memory. You know, that you could fight for people during the shutdown and help reopen businesses. And just, it's like far too many people have already forgotten, you know, okay, let me explain. So we're running for governor, you know, and people that you help get through the dark times, like, well, tell me why I should vote for you. And honestly, it was just so, you know, if I haven't convinced you by now, it's just a waste of time for me talking to you here. I mean, really? So, you know, remember where people were when it counted.
Right.
You were there when it mattered. You fought for people. You used your voice. You took the, you know, the ridicule and the bigotry from the left and the intolerance from the left. Some of the most bigoted, intolerant people and hateful people I know are on the left. And, you know, you were fighting for the citizens out there. And this is why, in part, I think you're going to be a great asset in Harrisburg, because you've already been through this. You've proven yourself. You've demonstrated, you know, loyalty, demonstrated commitment to our government and our Constitution. And when the stakes were down, you were there.
Well, I appreciate those kind words. And the thing that I try to say to people is, you know, stop looking for a knight on a white horse to come and save you. You know, somebody can be a leader, but they don't have to be there every step of the way and hold your hand and stuff like that. You know, for us to be successful, you know, we don't need we have to have a Donald Trump, we have to have a Doug Mastriano or a Ronald Reagan type person, but it's the people that make the difference. And it's the people that need to step up and stop looking for, you know, Moses to come down from the mountain with the Ten Commandments and he's going to save everybody and lead us to the promised land. You know, the people have to understand that they are the ones that hold the power. It's not the government. It's not a certain individual. It's not Senator Doug Mastriano, you know, is going to, you know, lead the charge in the Center City, Philadelphia, or anything like that, you know. And so, you know, again, you can present the facts, you can present the way forward, but it's up to them to take the next step.
You know, and that was borne out with the constitutional amendment that we moved out of the Senate to roll back the governor's powers, you know, from basically unlimited, open-ended to no more than 3 weeks without the consent of the people. And even though the powers of the government and the powers of the local, you know, radical left-wing media were on the side of Wolf, trying to retain those tyrannical powers, that the people got out. And, you know, even 30% of Philly came out and backed us on this year. And so the people, for the first, I think we're the only state to do this, to roll back the governor's emergency powers, so we cannot be shut down like that ever again.
Right. And I think that that was so important that people, you know, there was the opportunity for people to see that their voice makes a difference. That you know, you guys in the Senate and the House, you basically set the table, but it was the people that served the dinner, you know. And so, therefore, you know, we now, as you said, because of your efforts and other legislators, let's you know, be honest, yep, you know, other legislators as well, you know, we were able to basically tell Governor, you know, or as I used to call him, King Thomas Wolfe the First, you know, that you know, we're sorry, but your reign of terror over the people of Pennsylvania is over.
It was a beautiful thing to watch.
Yes.
I loved it. He could not believe it. He was in denial. He's like trying to figure some way around it. He's always got his way. You know, you can picture him as this petulant, spoiled kid growing up, the way he came out. Shutting down businesses, having these kingly powers, fear-mongering, you know, getting a good part of the population to, you know, be part of his muscle out there, like East Germany or something. But the people rose up and said, that's enough.
Yep. So switching gears a little bit, I you know, I'm looking at some of the things here. And so I want to start with something that I think is very important is yesterday was the 80th anniversary of D-Day. It was also my wife's birthday, but that's
wow,
yes. So, but you know, a lot of people. I would suggest if you watch, like I love watching the movie The Longest Day, and it really gives you a because it gives you the German side, it gives you the American side, which is same thing with Tora. That's why I like those movies, because you get to see both sides of the coin. But anyway, you know, let's talk about D-Day a little bit and the importance of what happened there.
Yeah, so 80 years ago, the 6th of June, 1944, it was called the Longest Day because really the fate of the war and of the nations and whether we defeat Nazism in Europe hinged on that one moment. And a lot of effort went into to deceive the Germans, try to convince the Germans we're going to land elsewhere. We're going to land at the narrowest part between France and Britain called Pas-de-Calais. And it worked. A lot of effort and manpower and casualties were generated to make the Germans believe we were not landing at Normandy. And because of that, there was a Panzer Corps waiting by Pas-de-Calais, and Hitler retained sole authority over those. And he was so convinced that Normandy was a deception that he sat on his armored forces till it was too late, when we had a foothold within Normandy. You know, Normandy was five beaches, with the American beaches being Utah and Omaha, and Gold, Juno, and Soar for the British and Canadians. Omaha was the bloodiest. You know, that's kind of captured in Saving Private Ryan. That scene there is all Omaha Beach. And the immense sacrifice and loss of life. You know, it was so uncertain that General Eisenhower, the Supreme Allied Commander, had drafted a letter, basically, should the operation fail. I mean, it was not a far-gone, you know, a known conclusion that this would be a success. If you think about the preparation, 6 months before, the 8th Air Force out of the United Kingdom and the British Bombing Command out of also the United Kingdom had launched Operation Point Blank. And there was a lot of concern about the German Air Force, the Luftwaffe, being able to foil our attack should enough airplanes get in the air to attack our ships and landing craft. And so those two bombing forces, Allied bombing forces, spent 6 months bombing Berlin, the capital of Nazi Germany, so that the Germans would be forced to put up a robust defense, and they lost most of their aircraft, most of their fighters defending Berlin. But one thing that we don't talk about is that in all the casualties together for the bombing forces, the 8th Air Force and British Bombing Command, I think it was around 80,000 men lost their lives. And this was all, you know, in part in preparation to ensure success. So it was a massive campaign. the day before Normandy happened, the landing at D-Day, it was great news in Italy. Rome had fallen. The Allies, British and American forces had rolled into Rome. So Franklin Delano Roosevelt was on the radio on the 5th of June, knowing the next day was going to be critical. And he excitedly announced the fall of Rome, captured by the Allies. And then the next day he got on the radio and did not give a speech, but he gave this long, heartfelt prayer, more powerful than most of the prayers you'll hear today from the pulpits, asking people to please pray to God for our men.
Well, one of the things that I think it, with D-Day, people don't realize is that the invasion was scheduled earlier, and they had to cancel it because of weather. And even on D-Day, it wasn't perfect conditions, and it was a tough decision for Eisenhower to make that call, because obviously rough seas, if the weather is bad, you know, you might miss your landing area. I mean, they didn't have the technology we have now, so you know, a lot of it was seeing with your eyes, and if you have bad weather, it's hard to do that. Air cover the whole 10 yards. And so the concern was if they didn't go, they had 500,000, I think it was 250 or 500,000 men, you know, amassed in England to do this invasion. So, it was, and like you said, there was no guarantee this was going to work. I mean, the Germans had plenty of time to put up defenses, and a lot of it had to do with deception. You know, as you said, they convinced them that the invasion was going to go elsewhere. And, we have to remember, I think around 4,400 people lost their lives that day. It was costly, but it gave us the foothold to retake the continent from the Nazi regime.
There was a lot of pressure from Stalin. You know, the Soviets had been taking the brunt of the fighting, obviously, you know, since the Operation Barbarossa was launched in June 1941 by the Nazis, the invasion of the Soviet Union. And the Soviets were losing, you know, millions of people in that battle. It was horrific. And there was a lot of pressure. So initially, the Allies had hoped in 1943, taking Sicily and beginning operations in Italy would be enough to take pressure off of Stalin and the Red Army, but it wasn't. And so initially they had hoped to maybe do something the year before. Churchill was against it. He was all for the soft underbelly, whether it's Italy, the Greece, or the Balkans. But Eisenhower's like, no, we need to launch into France. And when that happened, you're exactly right. The weather was uncertain. There was weather contingents from the United Kingdom, Commonwealth forces in Newfoundland and Greenland and Iceland. And they're setting up weather balloons, and they reported back this small window of opportunity on the 6th of June. Because it's not just the weather. It's also the moon, the tide.
Mm-hmm.
It's only a few days. And the weather window was so small that the German commander, Field Marshal Rommel, thought it was too risky for the Allies to invade on the 6th of June. So he went home to Stuttgart, Germany, to celebrate his wife's birthday. So
right. In
the midst of the most important day of his life, he's back on leave with his wife. It's fantastic.
Well, it's funny you said that, because, you know, a lot of times people don't realize that, you know, circumstances also play into that, you know. So the arrogance of the German high command, you know, Rommel, who was, you know, let's be clear, Rommel was a military genius. There's no doubt about that. Okay. But he saw the weather reports and stuff and said, you know, like you said, it's okay, because his wife's birthday was on the 6th of June. And so he said, hey, I'm going to go home and spend that with my wife. So their most knowledgeable commander, you know, was in Berlin. And the German high command had also scheduled war games at that time. So a lot of the commanders were not at their regular posts. You know, so again, circumstances, and the Allies don't know this. How do they know what the Germans are doing as far as war games, you know? So it's funny how, you know, I'll say it because I don't really care what people think. Sometimes God puts his finger on, you know, the people of righteousness. And in this case, the evil that was the Nazi regime had to be eradicated.
I agree. You know, and it comes at great price. And, you know, we talk about the significance of individuals like Reagan, you know, leading the charge and, you know, and rallying folks to righteousness. You know, there was a guy in 1934 that could have stopped Hitler. And his name was General von Schleicher. And he had the army behind him. He had the respect. And he was a member of the Weimar Republic. So he was part of the government, retired general. And he had his Esther moment we talked about. And, you know, when Queen Esther stepped in and risked her life saving the Jewish people at 482 B.C., you know, so von Schleicher had a moment like that. I won't say exactly, but he chickened out, and Hitler had him assassinated anyway, so he had nothing to lose, really. And so God raised up another deliverer, but it's going to take the United States Army to get there 10 years. So, you know, if you have your Esther moment, you need to stand in the gap, and, you know, that could have averted the Holocaust. I mean, at least it could have averted that without a Hitler around.
Right, exactly. So, you never know. You know, history, I always say to people, what you have to realize is you're silly if you don't learn from the lessons of history. And as time goes on, I had this argument back when in 91, which, of course, you were there, when the outcry was standing up to Saddam Hussein when he went into Kuwait. And I used to say to people, you know, you need to learn your lessons from history, that the Allies had a chance to stop Hitler in the very beginning, but Neville Chamberlain chose to take the road of appeasement. I said so, and Saddam Hussein basically is a dictator. And if we allow him to continue through appeasement, he's not going to stop at Kuwait. He's going to go into Saudi Arabia or wherever he can go. And so the United States stepped in, and we have one of the commanders here, Senator Doug Mastriano, and, you know, that was stopped.
Yeah, that was definitely a just war. And I know it was motivated by economic interest, you know, oil, but you're right. That would have given Saddam a control of, at that time, one-third of the world's oil reserves, and that would have given him massive power to control the world's reserves of oil, but also strategy. And so, you know, that was definitely what we had to do to put him in a box. And you're right. I mean, the Allies chickened out in 1937 when Hitler illegally sent his army in on bicycles, by the way, to the Rhineland to reoccupy that. And the French and British had their chance to stop him and didn't. Then they had a second chance with the Sudetenland, you know, the mountainous areas of Western Czechoslovakia, where there's a large group of ethnic Germans that Hitler wanted to take. The Allies could have stopped him there. And they didn't. And by the time they finally got motivated in 1939, Hitler had invaded and conquered Poland, and it was too late.
Fast forwarding, I also say to people that and this is just my opinion, but my opinion is if Donald Trump was still the president, we wouldn't be having this conflict going on in Ukraine right now.
Or Israel, for that matter.
Or Israel.
And we would not have those 13 dead, beautiful young Marine sailors and soldiers, you know, in Afghanistan and stability in Afghanistan. You know, Joe Biden has done more harm for the freedom of women than any other president in the world by allowing that country to be reoccupied by these intolerant bigots called the Taliban. Now the women can't be going to school. They have to, you know, wear certain clothes fully covered. And, you know, where's the outcry? You know, I'm really tired of the left and just how duplicitous they are and hypocritical they are, that when their side drops the ball, it's okay.
Well, you know, interestingly, because the election is coming up, we now have U.S. weapons being used inside of Russia. You know, and so is Joe Biden all of a sudden going to say, oh, you know what, I'm a strong guy, you know, and I'm going to stop Putin, you know, which really should have never happened in the first place.
This is really a dangerous track here. So imagine, remember how we responded, Don, was in 1961 or 62, the Cuban Missile Crisis?
Yes.
When Soviet missiles were put in Cuba, and we would have gone, we almost went to war over foreign weapons in a neighboring country. So what exactly are we intending to do here? Are we wanting to get dragged into a war with Russia, with NATO? I mean, are you kidding me?
Well, this whole thing is, to me, so it's funny. I was having this conversation with my brother-in-law last night. He's in town. We were talking about it. And I said, In my opinion, if Donald Trump was still the president, Putin would have never invaded Ukraine. And he says, well, you know, everybody says that Trump and Putin were buddies. And I said, okay. I said, Mike, I said, let me say this to you. Okay. They are both presidents of gigantic countries. I said, so they tried to say that Trump was like a buddy of the leader of North Korea. And I said, here is the greatest Trump moment. I said, and you need to understand how this works because politics is perception. I said, so remember the dinner that Trump was having in Mar-a-Lago, and sitting right next to him was the president of China. And if you remember, somebody comes up and whispers into Trump's ear, and that happened to be the moment that Trump fired those missiles into Syria. And isn't it amazing that they timed that moment where he fired the missiles into Syria with the Chinese president sitting right next to him, basically saying, if you mess around with Taiwan, we're not going to hesitate to take care of you. And so this is how these big leaders, that's why you always say Donald Trump plays chess while everybody else is playing checkers. There, if anybody thinks that was just we just happened to fire these missiles into Syria when I'm having dinner with the Chinese president. Yeah, you know,
you know, for people to try to, it's still pushing this propaganda from a Democrat machine, you know, talking point that there's this Russia collusion thing here. Man, those people need to freaking wake up. I mean, really? There's not one dot of evidence that any of that is real. Before a committee, before the Senate, you know, the Department of Justice was called out, you know, was anything true in the Steele dossier? And they said under oath, not one item in there is factual. And so if Putin is friends with Trump, then I guess Reagan was friends with Gorbachev. Really?
Well, look, yeah. See, what I say to people all the time is, you know, leaders have to have an open dialogue with other leaders. I mean, that is basically, you know, we saw, you brought it up, we saw that what could have happened if you don't have a good dialogue with the Cuban Missile Crisis, you know, and so thankfully, I believe it was Adlai Stevenson, who was the UN ambassador at the time, he made a great speech in the UN, and basically, I believe that's what carried the day. That and Kennedy's resolve to not go to war. So my question is really at this point, you know, now we have a president who is allowing U.S. weapons to be used inside a fellow nuclear power. Never before in the history this has happened, and this is opening up the door to a possibility of a really big problem.
It's really reckless because it's one thing to supply Ukraine to defend itself, and we could debate the merits of that. But I'm very empathetic and sympathetic to the concerns of our Baltic and Central European allies. I get it. But it's a different thing, though, when you're allowing those weapons to be used to aggressively attack Russian cities and units deployed in Russia itself. That's a whole different thing.
It is. And I think, to me, it's just reckless. I mean, because what if something accidentally happens?
But is it actually reckless? You're right. It's dangerous. That's clear. I think everything you guys have just said is correct. But is it reckless or is it intentional? I mean, I think we have to look to the people who are currently in control of our foreign policy, our foreign service, our military, our intelligence agencies, and ask them to what end are they using the United States' resources, the resources of the American people? What is their end goal here? And you know, as you've said, I think it's crystal clear. Had Donald Trump been in office, this wouldn't have happened because the issues that were raised leading up to the invasion could have easily been addressed.
Yes.
Or it could have been addressed when Boris Johnson went over there and said, no, you can't negotiate a settlement. There could have been a settlement negotiated that would have cost the average American citizen nothing. But it seems to me that this, while I consider this one of the three greatest existential threats we're facing right now, this war in Ukraine, I don't think it's reckless. I think it's intentional. I think they want this thing to ramp up, and I think they want to get American soldiers on the ground in Ukraine officially fighting.
And then, you know, if that does happen, then Russia's facing an existential threat. I mean, those are fighting for their little survival.
Right.
I'm not an ally or defender or an apologist for them, but the reality is, you know, their perspective is that this is an invasion. And
yeah,
this is as bad as, you know, anything they experienced in the other three invasions they had the past two centuries. And we're talking about tens of thousands of casualties with the possibility of things go cross-eyed with nukes.
Right. That's the wild card here. Because what if yeah. Putin, because we all know that Putin is basically, I'll use the word mad genius, because I think he's a very intelligent guy.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think that he has a kind of that KGB attitude, you know, of, you know, Russia, 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 you know, and I'll do anything for yeah. Mother Russia. And
or for himself.
Yeah, or for himself, correctly. Yeah. And so I don't think it would be out of the realm of possibility to consider that he might say, well, you know, we might have to use a tactical nuclear warhead here, you know, to protect ourselves. And that will be his justification. It'll be to protect themselves.
Uh-huh. If he gets to that position, I think everybody agrees there's no scenario whereby he simply walks off the battlefield. And I think one of the misconceptions we have is that we think we're just fighting him because the media likes to focus us solely on him. But if the Russian people weren't behind him, he wouldn't have been able to carry it this far. So it is fighting a nation. So, you know, you look on the other side, you've got one of the major architects of this war, Victoria Nuland. What were her intentions? Mm-hmm. Why did she make this happen? And, you know, everyone knows this now goes back to 2014, even 2004, and all the things that have happened since. What was her purpose? You know, and if you take it even further back to DITRA, you know, the Defense Threat Reduction Agency in 1991, when they said, listen, you've got nuclear and chemical and biological resources throughout the Soviet Union. There's no money, no organization to control those, that we're going to go in and fund the cleanup. That was I think everybody said, great idea. But what are we doing with all that now? And what was Victoria Nuland's purpose? I don't think that Victoria Nuland is a patriotic American who wants to use our resources for the good of mankind. I look at her as somewhat of a sinister figure. And so I think one of the reasons we're here is because people like her have caused this to happen and then they want to escalate it.
Yeah, I agree. But thank you, gentlemen, for having me on, Don. Look forward to having you in the saddle next week.
Yep, I'm looking forward to it. I'll be out there.
All right. Thank you, guys. God bless.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye. You know, and I want to make one other comment, Don. You know, you going to work with Doug, I think, is a critical element here. Because when you look at what's happening in Pennsylvania, we have a thin line of defense that keeps us from turning into California. If you go to what happened in the House this week, the Pennsylvania House, there was a bill that was before the Children and Youth Services Committee, Children and Youth Committee, House Bill 2037. This bill was designed to roll out vaccines in more ways, to get the kids more vaccinated, as if we don't have the most vaccinated kids in the world right now, and as if somehow there's no evidence that there's a problem with this. And the idea, I believe, behind this bill is that they would be able to start injecting children without parents' recommendations, without parents' knowledge and approval. Now, the Freedom Caucus on the House and the PA House side is fighting on all these things. Dave Zimmerman is on that committee. I believe he voted no,
right,
which is the only way you could vote.
Right.
Right. If you look at this bill, it's the only way you could vote. But, of course, they're outnumbered. So the Democrats want to push this kind of thing where the parents' rights are taken away and where the government decides what happens to your children. And what is the defense against that? Because if it gets to the governor's desk, Shapiro, who's positioned by all of his allies on both sides of the aisle as a moderate, is, of course, as radical as they can be. So if this bill were to make it to the governor's desk, it gets signed. And what stands in the way? That thin line of defense we have in the Pennsylvania Senate.
Correct.
That thin line of people like Doug who are standing there and saying, I will defend these parents' rights. And so, you know, you make a... That earlier part of your conversation was really interesting as you're talking about, you know, this makeup of the Senate, the role of the Senate and, you know, the history that Doug has shown. And there are people that have disagreements with Doug and people who have disagreements with all of us, right?
Yep.
A lot of people don't agree with a lot of my positions. That's clear.
Right.
Right. But we talk through them and work through them. But when you get down to it, when it really matters, when a bill like this hits the desk, we need people like Doug Mastriano standing in that Senate saying no.
Yeah, and the thing is that obviously part of the job that I will have to do, and Doug has told me this, is, you know, that speaking to other senators or their chiefs of staff or whatever, and figuring out where they stand on certain legislation and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we can convince them of our side of the argument, you know, why certain things should be passed or why a certain thing should not be passed. And I think you do that by you being firm, but being fair. Because I have found that confrontation doesn't ever really produce anything. And so my approach all through my business life and with people that may not agree with me 100% is, let's have the conversation. And tell me why you feel the way you feel, and I'll tell you the way I feel. And, you know, maybe, you know, like Doug said, you may not agree with me 70% of the time or 80% of the time, but this may be one of those times where we have to come together.
Right.
And so, you know, to take this approach of, I'm not going to hit you over the head with a 2x4, you know, instead let's have this conversation and let's see if we can come to some sort of a compromise that allows us to stay true to the Pennsylvania Constitution, U.S. Constitution, and individual rights and freedoms, which is the core beliefs of the conservative movement. And so that's the approach I'm going to take. You know, whatever Senator Mastriano says to me that he wants me to advocate for, that's what I'm going to do. You know, and I believe, as I had stated, the only reason I'm even consider taking this job is because we have the same beliefs. And so for me, this was a no-brainer. This was like that moment on West Wing where Leo McGarry said,
right,
your president has asked you to serve. I don't care if you're a Republican. Your president has asked you to serve.
I remember that, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
I saw that show later in syndication, yeah, and it was great.
Yeah.
But this you and I have talked about this for hours on this show. One of the great problems of the Republican Party is that it's not ideological.
Right.
That you've got, especially in leadership roles, in controlling positions, you've got a lot of folks who are simply opportunists. Maybe they have relationships with consultants and folks, and it's really just a money-turning venture. So you've lost all this ground in the Southeast. The Republican Party has lost, you know, Chester, Delaware, Montgomery County, no presence in Philadelphia that anyone talks about. It doesn't matter. Now, we see some of that changing. We've talked about it on this show many times now. You know, we see in the urban markets, and we've had someone on from Houston last week, the folks on from Philadelphia the week before, and a few weeks before that, other folks from Philadelphia talking about the change that we're seeing on the ground in the urban markets. That's a huge threat to the Democrat Party. But the only reason that's happening is because those voters, and maybe some of them weren't voters until just now. We talked about the right gentleman who just registered 6,000 new voters. These voters, whether they're new voters or old voters, they've not really had any reason to care to vote. Donald Trump standing up and saying, I'm standing firm on these issues. We can look back at his policies and victories that he had with his policies and how they benefited not the globalists, not the people who are stealing money through this Ukraine battlefield, but the people who live in places like Philadelphia, who live in places like Houston and the collar counties. And we see that when you are ideological, people will come to you. But when the party isn't, when it stands for nothing, it keeps losing, and they can't figure out why.
Well, see, and that to me, Gar, is the basis of the problem, is that in these collar counties, Philadelphia and surrounding counties, basically the Republican Party is more like the Democrats light. So, in other words, when you're asking somebody to vote who's not politically savvy, let's put it that way, and they look at two candidates, and the Democrats are saying all their stuff, and then you have the Republican guy who's afraid to say anything. So instead, you get the ad of him walking through the woods with the birds chirping and the butterflies flying, and he's walking his dog, and he's saying, vote for me, because it's a sunny day.
Right.
Okay? There's no contrast.
None.
There's nothing that says to the voter, okay, this is what the Democrats stand for, and this is what the Republicans stand for. And you have the left and you have the right. Well, now what you have in these collar counties is you have the Democrats here on the left and you have the Republicans Yeah, I'm using my hands and I'm on radio, so get that. That's but you have the Republicans either in the middle or a little bit on the left. And we see that in the House race, in the houses, where we had 16 Republicans vote for a Democratic House Speaker in the PA House. Mm-hmm. Then we had Republicans, Joe Hogan, KC Thomason, vote for red flag laws. Okay. After saying when he was running for office, Joe Hogan said, "I will never vote for red flag laws." And we brought that paper up. I posted it online. And then, of course, they vote for abortion funding and they vote for gun registration. You know, so there is no contrast. There's nothing that says I'm different. Vote for me.
So now the question, and we use this phrase frequently, that the Republicans are asking voters to buy a product that has no features. It is no contrast. There's no differentiation. There's no firm policy positions. And really significant challenges have come through and gone away without ever being addressed. If you think about the situation where we have, and analysis has shown, this is not some kind of a guess, they put child pornography in schools. We've known about it for 4 years. Very few Republican candidates have been courageous enough to talk about
it. Yep, you're absolutely
right. So here are the people that did that. One of the most scandalous things you could ever imagine happening. That opportunity was completely lost because everyone was told by the consultants and the party leadership, listen, don't talk about that. That'll offend the leftist. Do you think you were going to get Democrats and independents that were undecided to vote for a Republican who stands for nothing? If that issue had been used and should have been addressed by these folks, we might have had more control in school boards by now.
Absolutely correct.
But they refuse. So how do we know that this whole discussion we've had about the losses being because you've got a product with no features, a party with no policies, you know, absolutely no willingness to fight? How do we know? Donald Trump gets 34 criminal convictions and raises $400 million in a matter of a few days.
Right.
He's almost at $400 million right now.
You know, and we have a caller on the line. I'm going to bring him on. Mike has a comment he wants to make about compromise. But before we get to Mike, I want to say this. You know how they said that Donald Trump was convicted of 34 counts?
Yes.
Do you know 24 of them was a single count, but they did it 24 times because it was monthly payments? And they were able to say, oh, it was 24 payments. So that's how, so 24 of those 34 were really one single incident.
Right. But their audience doesn't know that.
No, I
right?
know.
Joe Main Street's out there. He did 34 different crimes.
Right.
It is one of our greatest problems as well as a nation is just that the American people appear to be very gullible and are not paying attention.
Right.
You know,
so, Mike, welcome to the Conservative Voice. It's great to have you calling in. You want to make a comment about the compromise?
Yeah, Don, Gary, how are you guys doing today?
Fantastic.
Good. Hey, I have a. Let me frame this. I guess this argument this way: if you have freedom on one side of the scale and tyranny on the other side of the scale, and someone is compromising, okay, in a compromise, each side has to give something up.
Correct.
So what would the left be giving up? Because I think if you look at history in terms of what we've compromised in terms of our rights, we are where we are today because of compromise.
So, Mike, let me ask you this question
Yeah.
Well, we have this opinion here. It seems to us, Gary and I have said this numerous times, that when the compromises come about, it's always the right side that's compromising and the left never gives anything. Gun rights.
That's my point.
Yeah. Gun rights would be the perfect example, for example.
Sure.
So that is your point. That's you agree with that premise.
Oh, absolutely. 100%.
So the thing is, if you're constantly...
My concern is when we compromise.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
No, you go ahead. Go ahead, Mike.
Yeah, okay, well, when we compromise, we end up where we're at today.
Right.
You know, $35 trillion in debt and then, you know, pile on the states and all this other stuff. Gun rights is absolutely the best example for, you know, for losing rights, losing freedom. So what would we, you know, as we go forward, when we talk about compromising with the left, are we talking about, you know, Doug Mastriano had said, we don't want to give up the kitchen sink.
Right.
But I think eventually you do.
Well, so, and I spoke when we, I'm sure you heard when we were, Doug and I were talking. So one of the greatest, one of Ronald Reagan's greatest strengths was, if you sound, I don't know how old you are, but for me, I got to see him.
29.
Yeah, sounds good to me. Isn't it amazing how many of those 29 birthdays we have? So Reagan's greatest strength was, I thought, how he was able to negotiate, work with Tip O'Neill, but still not surrender his core values. And so I look at what is happening, and I believe that's one of Donald Trump's greatest strengths, and I believe that's one of Doug Mastriano's greatest strengths.
Mm-hmm.
But we have too many people in the Republican Party who have lost sight of what the core values that the party is supposed to stand for. And so therefore, when they're compromising, so to speak, they have no – I was in the construction business, and there's no foundation. They have no foundation. So when they have no foundation, they just – it just all gets flushed down the toilet.
It's easy to surrender and call it compromise when you have never stood for anything.
Correct.
And that's the thing, is they continue just to surrender. And so I call this polite surrender, right? That's really the strategy they've executed for the last 40 years. These folks who get into Congress or get into a state legislature and just continuously yield to the other side so they don't get called a name, racist or bigot or whatever the name is of the day. They don't upset anyone. They don't get negative media attention. So they just continuously try to out-polite themselves until eventually there's nothing left to fight for because you've lost everything.
Yes.
It is not compromise to continuously surrender your points.
Yep. Well, Mike, I want to thank you for calling in. We have another caller on the line. Audrey, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
Hey, something I wanted to add to your compromise thing before I make a plug for my rally is, you know, somebody brought to light to me when they were running for Congress a while ago, and it's the price you have to pay to get on these committees, that you have to raise a certain amount of money, and you end up, you know, bargaining with the lobbyists, and then you're beholden to them. And that's where, you know, I not being naive, but you would hope, you know, these people with their intention originally is good, and then they go, and then they have no choice if they want to be active and get on the committee, and they pay this money, and now they're captured.
Well, and that goes to one of the things we've talked about on the show before, you know, campaign finance reform. And quite honestly, that's probably why it's never going to happen, because they these people like getting the money. That's why it's interesting how when these guys talk about term limits and look, let's be realistic. They're never going to vote to put themselves out of a job. I mean, you know, again, the only way this is going to happen is if the people make it happen. And so when a candidate talks about term limits, I pay no attention to that because it's never going to happen.
No, it's they're just making words that mean nothing.
They're just trying to, basically gin everybody up to vote for them. So, Audrey, I know you have a Trump rally that you want to talk about. Go ahead.
So we're having a Trump street rally. I've been doing this for 15 years and changed the signs apropos to whatever's trending. And I just felt like I kind of did this last minute, given the nature of everything in the news and the rigged trial for Trump, et cetera. And I felt everyone needed a positive injection. So we're having a street rally. Trump won't be there, but we're having a street rally to show our support to the community and the base tomorrow from 11 to 1 at 611 and Alms House Road. That's tomorrow, Saturday, June 8th, from 11 to 1 in Warrington, Doylestown, at 611 and Alms House Road. And if you want to use a GPS, 1282 Alms House Road, there's the parking right there. We have a big, huge shoulder and grass. If you can't stand, you can put a chair there. We have the Doylestown Police Cooperation, and they park their vehicle and make sure everyone's protected by cones so everyone's safe on the road from any traffic. And we have tons of flags and signs. You don't have to bring a sign if you don't have one. And we've got music. It's so much fun. It's a lot better than sitting and screaming at the TV.
And you've done this before. I know you. You've done ones, you know, you've had a couple hundred. 200 to 500.
To 300.
Yeah, exactly.
100 to 300 people. And if you need any gear and you want it, the Trump store down in Ben Salem has plenty of stuff if you want to have your own stuff. So feel free to go down there and
now,
get it.
Audrey, you mentioned a road there. What is that road? How do you?
Almshouse.
A-L-M. Yeah, A-L-M.
A-L-M what? A-L-M?
A-L-M-S-H-O-U-S-E. It's right by the Giant and the Kohl Shopping Center there on 611 in Doylestown, Warrington.
And you know, Aud, you might be able to use one of the things that we talked about with Senator Mastriano earlier. That of the 34 counts against Trump, 24 of them were for a single event, and that was for because the monthly payments of the money that he supposedly paid out was one out of one in 24. So 24 of those 34 accounts were for one single event. But it's like how they like to play that up as 34 people that don't have knowledge think he was convicted of 34 crimes, and that's not the case. He was convicted of, you know, made up crimes, but that's neither here nor there. So if anybody wants to jump out there tomorrow, please feel free to do so.
All right. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Audrey. Bye-bye.
All right.
You know, it's interesting. What they don't realize is that the more they do this, Gar, the more, like, you know, Trump raises more money, people become more galvanized, you know, and we talked about this last week on the show, that the United States is becoming, you know, Colombia, Venezuela, Nicaragua, you know, the USSR, China, North Korea, where dictators are able to use their political power in the government to persecute their political adversaries. And I believe that, you know, people are seeing through that, and the people are seeing that this whole trial was nothing more than a political witch hunt.
Well, it's become so crystal clear. I mean, the first trial on valuation of Mar-a-Lago was, I think, to everyone, obviously, it was self-evident. It was politically motivated and baseless. The fact that there was no jury, the fact that the judge was the expert that set the value, and that they valued his property at the value of an empty lot, Mar-a-Lago, an empty lot. I mean, so I think people really perked up at that and said, wait a minute. And that cut deeply into the New York deal-making community, who sat up and said, wait a minute, you can go back, because I've made some politician or bureaucrat angry, you can go back 10 years and open up some M&A deal or property deal or financing that I did, say I did it somehow improperly, even though no one lost any money, everyone was happy with the transaction, but a government official can come in and say, that was a bad deal and I'm going to destroy you on behalf of the government?
Well, think about this. Okay, you go to sell your house, okay? You want to sell your house. You're going to put the price tag on your house for what you think it's worth. But then what happens? The bank comes in and they do their evaluation and they say, "Look, you may think your house is worth $500,000, but we think it's worth $325,000."
Right.
And that's all we're going to, you know, let people get a loan for. Same thing that they're trying to accuse Donald Trump of doing with his businesses. He can value his business whatever he wants to value it at. That's your right as a business, as a landowner. Okay. But what happened here in New York is that the banks testified, they said, "I don't know what you're talking about here. He said one value, we said another. And ours is the one that matters when it comes to securing money." So there was no fraud here. There was no deception. There was no nothing.
Well, the only potential victims of this would have been, of course, the banks who testified on his behalf.
Right.
So now you've got both sides of the transaction telling the government there's no problem here. And the government saying, we think there is. So we're going to destroy this man. We're going to sue him. We're going to take $500 million from him. We're then going to ban him from doing business so that his business collectively collapse, because without the ability to do financings in New York, Donald Trump can't continue.
Well,
so the whole point was to destroy him. They go down that path, and the business community in New York starts saying, wait a minute, there I could go myself. And then you turn around and they do this second case, and all these folks are, it's obvious. And now we see in the polling and anecdotally, huge numbers of people transitioning
right
to supporting Donald Trump. And if he's going to hit $400 million of donations, it's coming. There's never been anything remotely like that. And of course, if you're voting with your dollars, it's a very good indicator you're going to vote that with your ballot.
Right. And what people need to realize before we take our break for the 1 o'clock hour, and we're going to have Greg Sennstrom on. We've had him on before, and Greg's going to talk a lot about election integrity and some other stuff. What people don't realize is that this whole thing with the Stormy Daniels and the hush money and all that stuff like that, even the federal government refused to prosecute this case. The New York district attorney jumped through hoops to make this happen. So, you know, keep that in mind. You're listening to The Conservative Voice here on WWDB, 860 AM. We'll be back after this short break.